That last line on the Playgirl cover, how to avoid a dead end affair.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Kind of seems, brings in the whole question of the loop as maybe it's as good as it gets.
Yeah, there's also
synth as good as it gets.
Oh my god!
My girlfriend had a blowjob during that film in the theater. First time she ever went down on somebody was in As Good as It Gets. That's beside the point, but I thought.
And now there's
jokes about it, but that's As Good as It Gets.
You know, the whole dead end affair thing also reminds me of The Shining. You know, when Jack is about to have an affair with the woman in room 237, turns out to be a dead lady.
Also, that goes to the end of the hallway to show you the photograph, which in itself is like a dead end.
Right. Exactly.
And if you don't know what your way out of a maze, you're constantly running into dead ends.
Right.
Which is how he died.
Yeah.
You know, an affair, can be a sexual affair, but it can also be a party, like an affair. So a dead end party.
Like the July 4th ball.
Yeah, so they part the affair at the end of the dead end.
What that whole angle I was bringing up a couple episodes back or a couple of weeks back about Hal as a computer with some sort of intelligence recognizing his own dead end affair, that if some catastrophe were to befall the human components of his ship, he would just be floating out in space with no one to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, which makes him Scorpio in a way, because part of the symbolism of Scorpio, there's a few things, but one of them is that Scorpion is one of the few creatures that will commit suicide if it has no other option. So Scorpions have actually been known in certain circumstances to stab themselves. And if Hal is the brains of the ship and he recognizes that this mission is too important to allow you to jeopardize it, what does he do but kill off the crew? He's basically committing suicide, all for the good of the mission, but not realizing that it's himself, which is what the ego itself in the first place does in order to protect it. It's a coping mechanism. So we hurt ourselves in the attempt to hurt other people. It's insane, but we do it.
Around,
right? You get
around
somebody,
Galactic Center is
that's it, exactly what you're doing.
Around Galactic Center is Sagittarius, the Bowman. Dave Bowman is Sagittarius, the Archer. Pointing at Galactic Center. You also have Ophiuchus, there's a snake in my boot, and Scorpio. Scorpio's tail is also right by Galactic Center.
Right.
Right, and I'm sure you have the Tom Hanks says there's a snake in my boot in Toy Story, which Toy Story is inspired by Freud's The Uncanny, which is also what The Shining is, but then the fact that Tom Hanks is in Apollo 13, and then Danny wears the Apollo sweater. I don't know, and the Apollo is the sun, right? Sun god, right? Is that correct? I forget. But anyway.
Just keeping it within 2001, it's the Buzz Lightyear who goes to infinity and beyond. He goes beyond the infinite. literally, to infinity and beyond. He's going beyond the infinite.
Right.
That's more puppets or, kind of like Muppets, I guess.
Are the Muppets and these living toys from Toy Story and the puppets from the Muppet movies, are these, in a way, their own form of AI, homunculus, golem figures?
Yes.
It's like the Ghost in the Shell.
Totally golem figures. They're inseminated with life. It's the same premise. They have no soul, but they're given a relative existence completely. So actually, Apollo, according to Nietzsche, in The Birth of Tragedy, is referred to as the Shining One. He says that etymologically, even though this isn't, I went to look it up further and it's hard to completely back up, but it's a lot of these etymologies when it comes to these things are open to debate. But what Nietzsche claims is that Apollo means the shining one, which I find interesting in terms of Danny and
Apollo
13.
Isn't that also the meaning of Sirius, though? Sirius, I mean, it was the blazing star, but I think it also means shining.
I've never heard that.
Sirius means a scorcher. That's what the scorching, etymology denotes. Sorry, and it's because it's the hottest days of summer or what it signals. Through the Egyptians paid attention to it to recognize when the Nile is going to rise. So the waters, you know, so that they could get their crops taken care of.
So did you guys see The Killing, or have you guys not watched that yet?
I've seen it several times, but I was meaning to watch it again, but I was busy.
I did watch it this week in preparation. Yeah.
Do you guys want to save that? Because I got a bunch of stuff on it.
Can I just make one quick point about Overlook Hotel real quick?
Of course, yeah.
Just in regards to the whole architecture of a sun square, I'm trying to think of, as I was walking around the city of Chicago and just visualizing it being, you know, a 6x6 square, which has a harmony and resonance where every direction equals the same thing. You know, it's all Chicago, whatever path you take. And in order to run a sun square, you need to have all these little center points, you know, working with each other. And that the Overlook Hotel exists in a square that is isolated from the sun square. It's a black hole sun square. So, you know, when it, there's a certain kind of entropy that's involved when a square is isolated from the engine of something like a sun square. So things start to decay and break down in an effort and or an attempt to return to the harmony that it came from. So if the Overlook was sort of an extension of a city where wealth and money and prominence was established, over time, when that connection is lost, it seeks to restore itself to where it once was. So that when Jack and Wendy and Danny are in the isolation of that isolated square, it draws them in just like a black hole in an attempt to break them down to make it into the multiple components of what it once was.
Totally, precisely.
Okay.
So that's the thing, is that a black hole is produced by the supernova expansion of the sun, when the sun becomes too big for its britches, basically. The sun square is foundational in that the other squares are basically fit into it on top of it.
Okay.
And as we've seen demonstrated in that really fucking great obscure video that's like Protestant or whatever of basically how the sun square works, is you generate this spiral that work as steps when you fold the square into itself in a cylinder. But the fact that the Jupiter square fits into it, as well as the Mars square being at the top, and the center of the Mars square is 13, which is the goddess. And so you have the same idea that basically it's taking the energy of the Shekinah in order to build. So it needs this energy, which is the receptive principle, in order to expand itself. But inevitably, because of the nature of the thing, is it's just like a mandala. So it's the same premise as a mandala, that you put this energy into this thing, knowing that it's destined to fail in the end. So, and then I consider the relationship completely. I've considered that the Overlook is just like the Discovery, in the sense that it serves a relative purpose, but it in itself isn't the end. So if you take it as the end, then that's what you see. You see a failure. If you transcend that level of appearance, then you can see that it finishes on it comes back around on another level, which is saying the same thing for our physical body and life, that if you see the physical body as an end, you're in for some serious despair, because you're going to watch birth, growth, decay, and death take place, and you're going to be like, oh, what?
So this would speak to the body of America. I mean, everyone pretty much knows that America is in the way. Correct? On some level or not.
And isn't this, I just want to say that to the, because the same thing. So the idea of something being in the way or like blocking your view, the idea of being an overlook, I actually would, you know, this idea of the overlook is the space station, or is it the Discovery or is it the space station? The idea of like sort of being at the high point to look out over everything.
Okay, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Totally. And then you have the fact that, so the moon on the, so we can all basically agree most likely that if you're looking at 2001, you're looking at a progression through the four worlds, right? At least in the European system, where Malkuth, it starts out, you're at the dawn of man, you're at Earth, right? And then the film itself, in a sense, is divided into four parts. And so you go from that, you go from the Earth to the moon, right? Which is Yesod. You're going up the middle of the tree. So you go from Malkuth to Yesod. You fly around the sun, which is the Pink Floyd lyric on Echoes, which is what goes in sync with Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. No one flies around the sun, but what do you know? The Discovery had to have flown around the sun if it's going to get to Jupiter. But then it's interesting that you have Jupiter and Saturn there in the European system at the top. So I don't know. I think it's interesting that in the book you have it Saturn, and then in the film you have it Jupiter, and there's this relationship between the conjunctions of Jupiter and Saturn. But, you have Beyond the Infinite is beyond the veil. So you move beyond to Aught, and you reach the Supernal Triad, which is the ending, you know. I don't know. It seems pretty apparent, but that's fucking weird.
I've never seen. I'm sorry to keep scattering this, but taking this as Jack Torrance, this movie Wolf, I've actually never seen, but I just wanted to look into it. The idea of Jack Nicholson as a wolf, since we're connecting him to Sirius and all this sort of stuff, in the movie. Apparently it's him and Michelle Pfeiffer.
And James Spader.
Well, yeah, but now I just want to...
Which is where we have our Spade, which is where we have our death.
Yes. But last night I watched Lady Hawk, which has Michelle Pfeiffer being in love with a wolf. So now...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Weird.
Which is all... I mean, I watched... Okay, all right. Yesterday... David, you might find this. Yesterday, I went to see Swan Lake at Lincoln Center. My wife,
nice.
My wife has danced ballet for many years, so she's really into. So she wanted to see Swan Lake. So we watched it, and it's the first time I ever actually saw the story. And then it's like this idea of this curse is put on this girl that she's gonna be a swan. This evil sorcerer puts this spell on her that she has to be a swan, so even though she falls in love with this guy, sorry, at night she turns back into a girl. And
oh, just like the werewolf.
Well, it's kind of the opposite. At night, she during the day, she's a swan, and at night, she's a girl. So this guy finds her. He goes out into the woods. He gets a new crossbow, so he's like a hunter, and he's about to kill the swan. He sees her turn into a girl. And then he falls in love with her and blah, blah, blah. And they have to, like, try and win her away from the sorcerer. And it's really weird because at the end they just decide to commit suicide. And somehow that them committing suicide, they're together in the afterlife. And it kills the sorcerer at the same time. It was kind of a weird ending. But I said to my wife, I said, oh, this is like the movie Lady Hawk. I had to be inspired by this. So we watched it. And in it, the... woman who turns into a bird is in love with a guy. They take it a step further. The guy also has a curse on him that he turns into a wolf. And you see that guy has the crossbow. So this crossbow carries over. And again, it brings him to the archer, the bowman, right? So the bowman is in love with this sort of shape-shifting woman and has to sort of break this curse. I just think it's really interesting, though, that in this movie Wolf, it's also Michelle Pfeiffer, who is again with a wolf figure. I think that's fascinating.
Totally, and then she's Catwoman.
Right. Mm-hmm. So cats and dogs laying together.
Yeah. okay.
So I didn't mean to throw that on a tangent. Just like. While looking at this, I was like, what the fuck? Here's Michelle Pfeiffer again?
Right. So this is, I'm trying to remember what this was that I just saw a film, and I don't think it was Michelle Pfeiffer. Maybe it was Nicole Kidman. Was it Rabbit Hole? Maybe it was Rabbit Hole.
Is it on Skinamax?
Where basically she's talking on a CB to talk to God. And after I saw that, the CB had been coming up repeatedly, and I can't remember all the examples. I should have written them down. Right now I'm thinking Christian Bale, which is like Christian Baal. But there was a bunch of CBs that came up, and I was thinking about the fact that there is this expression, and I think it may have been Rabbit Hole, but I'd have to double check. It was this other thing. Anyways, it was somebody who had a dead child and they wanted to communicate with their child on the CB.
Oh, that's what is that?
I just saw that.
Was that what's his face? It was a dude talking to his son, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, anyway, maybe there's more than one. Anyways, Chewbacca. Chewbacca has a fucking crossbow.
Yes.
Right?
Sorry, that's...
And, totally. It's just this idea that you have, like, we were all talking about the Bowman.
Yeah, but
and you have
Chewbacca has the crossbow, and he gets in the Millennium Falcon.
Right, which is Osiris.
But
right?
No, the Millennium Falcon has to be Horus.
Oh, Horus. I stand reflected. that's, like, this whole thing of, like, you know, in the first place, we're like Sagittarius, right? Okay, in tarot, the major arcana that corresponds to Sagittarius, Crowley called art. In the original, it's temperance, right? Temperance is the 14th major arcana. It's interesting that when you look at it, you have the triangle on his chest, and you have the sun symbol on his forehead. But you have the sun and water. You have fire and water. The Purusha Prakriti, or the Star of David, is made up of two triangles, which is basically fire and water. The name David as a verb literally means to boil, which is what happens when you put fire and water together. Mm-hmm. The fact that the card is 14 is interesting in regards to the fact that in Rosicrucianism, the Rosicrucian cross is made of 14 surrounding points. There's 14 segments that surround the Rosicrucian cross. The Rosicrucian cross is meant to be folded into itself so as to generate the cube, right? And so they express that the rose, which is the essence, the eternal part in the midst of the unchanging, is in the center of this cube. And so then that's expressed with Metatron, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on for fucking ever via the Seed of Life business. Anyway, I find it interesting that you have Bowman, and then we're connecting this with David Bowman, and that's the Star of David, interestingly enough, Dalet, Vav Dalet, which is door, nail, door, in terms of pictographs, but I don't know.
Is door, is nail, door, nail, like a 101?
Yeah.
Right?
Isn't nail, that's five, right? Or vowel?
Six.
Okay.
Like if you look at like Monster, the drink Monster, it's so blatant that they put Vav 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 is how they make the M. So, which is why they have the phi symbol there for the O of Monster. So, you just watched The Hangover, and they my girlfriend was like, oh, look, there's an advertisement. When they wake up, the first thing they show you is Monster. And then on the other side, there's like a fucking rooster walking across the room or whatever. I was like, huh, that's funny. Because Rooster being Hermes, and then you have anyways. But I don't know. I was kind of tripping out on that a little bit. The idea of all of that, basically. And then you have the crossbow is like the bow and arrow of Sagittarius, and then obviously the cross, and these 14 points that make up the Rosicrucian cross, temperance, et cetera, et cetera. And anyways, Chewbacca, CB, communicate with the cosmos.
CB's also 32, just 23 backwards.
The number of pathways on the Kabbalistic tree of life in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, you say 32. So there's in in Swan Lake, where they jump into the lake at the end to commit suicide, the Deadpool, bring it back to the Deadpool, my wife made a big deal about how in the middle of the Black Swan scene, she does a... She says this is this famous scene where she does 32 turns. And I was thinking, why 32?
There you go.
Yeah, they take the Sphero and the connecting paths are all called paths. So the Sphero themselves are pathways, too. So they say 32 pathways. That's a huge thing in Kabbalah.
Right. Hmm. Now, what do you think of this? Apparently, for our moon child, for the movie Wolf, instead of Michelle Pfeiffer, it was originally supposed to be Mia Farrow.
Weird.
So your moon child?
Uh-huh. Totally. Weird. I wonder why they didn't do that.
It says, considered too controversial a choice by the film company due to the then-current Woody Allen and Soon Yi affair. A dead-end affair.
So, have you guys seen Alice? The Woody Allen film, Alice?
No.
I haven't.
It's worth watching. It takes place in New York, right? And so she basically gets hypnotized. And the whole thing is basically around hypnosis and different drugs that she's given by this old Chinese man who is the Chinese man in Gremlins, which is interesting. So Gremlins is with Hoyt Axton is Billy's father in Gremlins. Hoyt Axton wrote the song Joy to the World when he says Jeremiah was a bullfrog and a good friend of mine.
All right.
Understood a single word he said, but he helped me drink his wine. And he also wrote Steppenwolf's The Pusher, where he says God damn the pusher man. That's father in Gremlins who wrote that.
Really?
Accident. So I don't know. I was looking at the song Joy to the World and how, like, that's, I don't know. There's an interesting idea there because we're going into the whole frog business. And you had mentioned the Frog Prince, Alan. You turned me on to that, and I went and watched it after you had mentioned that to me, the Muppets Frog Prince.
Isn't it great? I mean, I don't like the musical scenes, but I love the whole... We talked about spoonerisms, where there's basically a curse is placed on this girl that she can only speak in these sort of encrypted spoonerisms. So everything she says, and throughout the thing, she keeps saying there's a evil witch, and she keeps telling, I think it's Robin, the Christ frog, she keeps telling him, bake the hole in the candle of her brain. She keeps saying,
right, which is the handle of her cane.
Yeah, break the ball in the handle of her cane is what she's really trying to say. But instead, she keeps saying, bake the hole, which brings me back to The Shining. Bake the hole in the candle of her brain. I love it. I just fucking love that line.
It's also the July 4th ball.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. The candle in her brain. This is, again, the torchbearer.
Right.
Kindle brain. CB.
Very,
right. There's another CB. Good one. The candle of her brain is like total the pineal, you know. But what
Princess Diana,
fucking weird.
Princess Diana's sapphire ring, and she was the candle in the wind.
Right. Totally. And she's the rose, right?
England's rose, that's right.
Right, which is, you know, and Elton John did, my favorite Elton John song is Gray Seal, which if you listen closely, he says Great Seal. I mean, it's obviously about Great Seal, you know, the Great Seal on the dollar bill, which is the right. High, super huge recommendation is looking at the lyrics of that fucking song. Like, I think that that's some of the best lyrics ever written, and it's pretty sly, like, you know, the levels of what he's saying. It's fucking genius. On the big screen, they showed us the sun, but never bright in life is the real one. You know, he goes some shit there. Anyway. So, you said you needed to go, Alan.
Yeah, I got about half an hour here, and I know Tommy wanted to drop in the killing. We pushed this back 2 weeks. If you want to drop some killing stuff on us, Tommy, I'd love to hear it.
All right. Well, everyone here's seen it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bill, did you watch it recently?
Yeah, I watched it yesterday.
Okay, awesome. Okay.
Oh, good. All right, so the movie opens on the fifth race, and I've been reading the Illuminatus trilogy recently, and there's all this stuff about the Law of Fives and 23 and all that. It's funny you should mention CB and all that, because, you know, that fits right in. So he says he's like $20 to $30 on this race, and there's another 23, which is 2 plus 3 is 5, so we got that. And
did you notice the numbers on the horses, the first horses you see?
Yeah, I wrote that. I wrote a bunch of stuff down. I was like, oh my God, what am I revealing here? That is 3, 11, and 7. And he mentions their names as being Lucky Arrow, which is the bowman, you know. I think Jupiter is associated with luck, right? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you'd say fortune, right?
Right. So Lucky Arrow, so you have Jupiter and Sagittarius and all that, Purple Shadow, and Southern Star. Yeah.
I didn't catch the names of the horses. I was too busy looking at their numbers.
Yeah. What do you think about the significance of those numbers, Alan?
Well, I thought first you see it as just 311. You don't see the 7 show up. So for me, 311 is a 33. You always see the 311 broken down that way. But then when the 7 comes into the view, then I don't want to stretch it too much, but if you could break that down as either 3 7s, so your 3 7 is your 777 is your lightning flash of creation, or you break it down the same way is the 11 and the 7 is the 77, bringing it back to Oz and all that. And I don't know if you add them up, you get a 21. Was that your blackjack?
Yep.
It's blackjack.
Yep, blackjack. So horse has 5 letters, and horse is another name for heroin. I'm not really sure how that ties in, but
Does. Yeah, definitely. And Bill just wrote here: if 11 equals 2, the 1 plus 1, then you literally have 3 2 7. That's incredible. Yes. Because they're in that order. You see 3, then 11, then 7. It's actually broken down that way. So you have room 3. Holy shit, I didn't even think of that.
Hey, guys, the 15th episode of the second season of Stargate SG-1 is called The Fifth Race.
Really?
That's crazy. So there's more 5. There's a ton more 5s. But first... The loan shark, his name is Leo. So you have, Leo, the sun, and all that.
Strength. There's our 77 again.
Precisely, yeah.
And it's revealed that Faye and Johnny have been separated for 5 years while he was in prison or in jail, I think. And then we go to Sherry and George, who have been together for 5 years. And they actually plan the heist in a group of 5, and they actually form a pentagram around the table.
Correct.
As they're going over the plans, and this ties into there's this thing in the Illuminatus trilogy called the Sacred Cow. It's supposed to be like one unit of chaos, and the symbol is a yin yang, and In one little, I guess they look like fish or something. You could tie that in. In one half of it,
yeah. The yin yang. I definitely see Pisces as the yin yang.
Yeah, I think Jake talked about that a little bit. In one half of it, there's a pentagon, and the other half, there's an apple. It's the golden apple of, Eris. And I saw Sherry as being the golden apple, you know. And the group of 5 dudes as being the other half. And that kind of blew my mind a little bit because she represents that element of discord that totally, fucks up their whole plan. And even when you cut an apple in half, the seeds form a pentagram.
Correct.
I think everyone knows that. So 5 is also the hierophant, right, in the tarot? and he represents the trickster. You know, the one, I forget the exact, like, wording of it. But well,
that was, Jason just pointed out to Alan when you put up the in Private Joker thing, mm-hmm. that when Crowley describes the Hierophant, is that he's hiding a private joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Murky, like he's hiding this private joke.
Like Kubrick.
And when right. and when your golden apple dies in the killing, she says that this must be some sort of sick joke. No, it's a,
right.
it's a joke without a punchline.
A joke without a punchline.
So,
oh my God.
Guys, you know, the immediately I hear Fifth Race and I was like, that's, you know, in Theosophy, the Fifth Race is what we're in right now. And that's the Aryan. So Blavatsky asserted humanity was presently in the fifth root race, the Aryan race, which Theosophists believe to have emerged from the previous fourth root race, which is the Atlantean root race,
oh my God.
100,000 years ago in Atlantis.
Atlantis is totally prevalent in the Illuminatus trilogy, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally. Totally
the first person to ever mention Atlantis is Plato. And Plato basically asserted that he got that information from Egyptian priests while visiting Egypt. Just putting that out there. That most people don't. I mean, a lot of people have their associations with Atlantis, but that's the earliest piece of writing that we have that mentions Atlantis is actually from Plato, anyway.
So, I think Johnny gets this guy to, he's holding a puppy for whatever reason, during the scene where he's introduced. And he gets him to take a $5,000 hit on a horse called Red Lightning.
Yeah, the lightning strike, exactly.
So, and his jockey's name is Danny, which is five letters. And
ooh, and then Red Rum.
Red Rum.
Red Rum is the name of a super famous horse in horse racing.
Are you fucking serious?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I remember you had talked about that, David, and there's like a perfect mirroring thing going on with this movie because you have The Killing and then you have The Shining. You know, it's
right.
two movies where you can sort of spoonerize, albeit a little clumsier, but, you know, with the horse and, yeah, fucked up.
Wait, what would you make that?
What's that?
You're saying if you spoonerize The Shining and The Killing.
Well, I mean, maybe I probably didn't use that correctly then. Just that, you know, out of all the movies that Kubrick did, you know,
the names,
The
are
Killing
so
and The Shining are just a few letters different. And then you have the main, one of the main sort of MacGuffins in each movie, Red Rum on the door and Red Lightning in the race. There
yeah.
was a Red Rum horse.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of Red Lightning flash going on at the Overlook Hotel. It's just this guy weaving things on such a fucking level.
It's the Hierophant.
Yeah, it's spooky.
So I was also reading that five is something called Grummet. I don't know where that comes from, if it's a German thing. It's Grummet. I think it's, I don't know where it came from, but it stands for Violent End.
Oh, interesting.
So, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Red Rum was prepared for the sixth attempt at the Grand National the season following his 1977 win, but suffered a hairline fracture the day before the 1978 race and was subsequently retired. However, Rummy had become a national celebrity, opening up supermarkets and annually leading the Grand National Parade for many further years. His likeness graced playing cards, mugs, but anyways, I'm sorry.
The
horse helped opened the steeplechase roller coaster at Blackpool Pleasure Beach in 1977. He also switched on the Blackpool Illuminations in that year. What is Blackpool Illuminations? There's a song. The song entitled Red Rum was issued as a tribute to him by a group named Chaser. We need to look this up.
You made a, when you mentioned the horse getting the fracture, that really pieces it together for me because traditionally in horse racing, if the horse breaks its leg, it's either killed or just put out to stud. So it's either all it gets to do is fuck or die. Again, you have your
right.
your death principle and your pleasure principle. So the a horse with a broken leg either fucks or dies. Well, in the Arthurian Grail King, you know, this idea of the Fisher King or the Grail King, he has a wounded leg, which is sometimes a wounded genitals or a wounded leg. And Nikki, the guy who shoots Red Lightning, he pulls into the parking lot, and that guy says to him, "Oh, you can't park here." And he says, "Listen, I'm a paraplegic." And the guy goes, "Oh, yeah, me too. I'll also." And you see him limping, and they talk about how they both got their legs injured in the war. So Nikki pretends that he has the leg wound, and the attendant at the parking lot actually does have a leg wound.
And how many letters does Nikki have?
Yeah, sure. But I'm just thinking of it as the idea that here they have this sort of racial struggle where the parking attendant is this black guy who suddenly thinks that this white guy is being nice to him, so he's being nice to him, and then Nikki says something like, you know, you're wrong, nigger. Like, he says, you're wrong. And it's this idea, again, of this, but that's the guy who ends up killing him. Right, Nikki shoots the horse, but the black parking attendant shoots him. Now, if we take this as the Grail Quest, ultimately you have the black stage, and here you have him rising up. If you can guys can kind of follow this train of thought, the black Grail King with the leg wound is killing the other white king with the leg wound. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, there's also the chess thing in the movie. That kind of reminds me of chess a little bit.
And if I'm not mistaken, the guy who plays George, his last name is Cook, bringing it back to The Shining.
Really?
The actor's name.
Right, and then you have Captain Hook is like a play on Captain Cook, too. You know, that's kind of weird. And then Hook is Saudi. So Saudi, the letter Saudi, was the star, and then Crowley makes this thing that Saudi is not the star, and then attributes it to the emperor, and then makes the emperor's hay into the star. That's kind of weird because I went into this in my blog, was that you have a czar who's like, you say, the new drug czar or whatever it is, you know, basically the head. It literally is taken to mean head, is, you know, T-S-A-R, which is interesting because it's an anagram of star, which is weird because it's one switching to the other. Like, and then you have the Tsar bomb, which was the biggest nuclear bomb that's ever been built, that's ever been tried from Russia. So I don't know. There's some crazy levels there in that regard. The Hook particularly, I was tripping out on like Captain Hook, but then also looking at Wendy being this kind of idea of Lilith as the wind. But then I was looking at last night, Peter Pan with his shadow. He loses his shadow, and then she sews the shadow back on.
That's right.
And the way Lilith is described in terms of the tree is that she's the shadow of she rules the shadow of the tree. She doesn't actually rule the tree, but she influences the tree.
Yes.
So does she rule Kether? No, fuck no, of course not. But it's the backside. And so this whole idea of like sewing back on the shadow of Pan, who is a composite character of Hermes and Pan. Pan is Hermes' son. And when Jesus goes through his tribulations, there's two mountains that he has these two episodes on, including his transfiguration right before his death. One is on Mount Hermon, and the other one is a mountain sacred to Pan. And there's a huge Pan statue there, and there's all this Pan worship there. But anyway,
I love that his shadow doesn't Peter Pan's shadow doesn't cooperate with him, and it's Wendy that sort of helps him to tame his shadow. It's very much the strength card again.
Yes, exactly. And the strength card is the Vestal Virgin, right? Who is also the May Queen, who's sacrificed in the Burning Man.
Yes,
among other ways. But just that idea that she's the sacrifice. The Shekinah is also the sacrifice. But you can't. All you can do is exile the thing. You can't destroy it. And you can utilize it in different ways. But she always wins in the end because she always rises. The only way for her to not rise is for her to literally be pushed down. And so this is where you can see, like, there's a correspondence between this idea and Kundalini, because she is actual sexual energy. So there's this whole idea that her rightful place would be in the heart, and in the middle brain is actually how it's described in 16th century Kabbalah, which is interesting because it's basically talking about the pineal, as far as I can tell. So you have this idea that, you know, you have this energy that's being pushed down, but that the energy could actually be allowed to flow. And then there you have our, you know, our backwards wolf, you know, and the idea of flowing energy, energy being allowed to flow and not simply constrained. And what is the wolf in a sense, but that energetic is like repressed energy. And so you have the idea of the id also follows suit. And then you have Wilhelm Reich, Orgon energy is basically same thing as Kundalini, of that what happens when you repress. And so I can see Kubrick working with psychology blatantly. He references Freud, and then you obviously see the Red Book sitting there. So he's obviously pointing out repression. Why do parents molest their children? What are we looking at here? We're looking at the symptoms of repression. And so, and that's what happened. That's the whole thing with the Shekinah. You know, she is being repressed. That's what the exile is. And then in her place, we have this substitute who Christians refer to as the horror of Babylon. And so,
David, didn't you also connect this to the name Elisha? Because in the character who plays George with the last name Cook, his first name is Elisha. His name is Elisha Cook.
Huh. Weird. Yeah. I come up. Hold on. I'd have to look that up again. I forget what happened there.
Yeah, because I remember you talking about Elisha as a similar sort of archetype here. Can I also just throw out that the main character's name
Big
is...
Big time. So,
oh, go ahead.
It's David Bohm. So, isn't that right? So, Elisha played... Oh, hold on. So... What's the deal? So there's two. Elijah and Elisha. So David Bohm, the character who plays David Bohm, as I recall, played Elisha in Give Us Barabbas.
Yes, and that's so it. That's it.
Plays the New Testament Elisha, but the New Testament Elisha is suggestive of the Old Testament. They're playing games there. So Elisha was Elijah's successor. And when Elijah gets taken up, he receives Elijah's cloak. So anyways, that was the blog before last that I went off about that. So anyways, yes, thank you.
Well, there seems to be a biblical narrative going through this. Is the main character's name is Johnny Clay, which again would connect him to Adam Kadmon. He's the clay man. So is it,
right.
You know, and
the golem.
Great. As I say, he could be the golem, or he could be the first golem, the first human golem of Adam, the man made out of clay. So, you know, if you want to take it that sense, we're all golems if we're all descendant from the clay man.
Right. Except the difference is that we have a nephesh that is our own. But that's actually backwards, even the way that it's described, because our nephesh has our clay, so to speak.
Right.
Whereas the difference with the golem is that he's being influenced by another nephesh. So he isn't an emanation of a nephesh. He's from the other side, which is kind of indicative of the klipot, because they are the outside ones. It's the same kind of premise. It's like you're working with an energy that's not necessarily the same. From the same place. It's being inseminated, but not in the same way we are. So it gets kind of complicated, but yeah.
Yeah. Just to follow that biblical narrative, the movie ending with the two guys who find Johnny in the airport are those the sort of two witnesses of Revelation. I'll just sort of throw that out to you with the whole idea of dealing with horses. You have the four horsemen. You know, if you want to play with it that way. And if we had more time, we could even take the Nicias, the sharpshooter who's killing the horse, we could bring that to the sniper from Full Metal Jacket, again, going with your shell or your husk.
Right. There's also the idea that Sagittarius is the sniper.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then you have David Bowman.
And Sagittarius is half horse, is he not?
Right.
Yeah, he's a centaur. He's
also, yeah.
He also is Zeus with the lightning. So
which is funny because I think center you know.
Uh-huh.
Right. Which reminds his arrow is aimed at the galactic center, you know.
The galactic centaur. Awesome.
Galactic centaur.
So go ahead, Tommy. You said you got more here.
I really don't. But it seems like the whole movie is about gambles. You know what I mean? Because they don't know if the whole thing is going to go through. And then when it does, when there's some kind of order that seems to be revealed, you know, we're all going to get our cut, and everything goes apeshit. And in that scene where Val Cannon, which is, there's something there, I'm sure. Val Cannon is his name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. and some other dude, they stick up the three guys who are still in the room. And George is in the other room, so there's another 23. And then George comes in as that sort of sixth element, you know, that kind of breaks up the order and disorder comes. And, you know, I was kind of perplexed by the last scene with Johnny at the airport.
As a not magical way of reading into this, just as a... The first time I saw The Killing years ago, I was so unimpressed because the whole movie's building up this, like, suspense of, like, blah, 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 and, like, the music gets all dramatic and dramatic and dramatic. And then he's at the airport, and he's going to escape, and she goes, Johnny, you should run. And he's like, oh, what's the use? And it's just the end. It's, like, basically, like, we got this whole movie building up, and it's like, fuck it, the end. We're done.
See, I saw that as being pretty symbolic, though. It's like, what's the use, you know, there's this higher order that's going to bust up your order anyway, so you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, sure. What was the movie with the Rat Pack where all the money burns, it gets cremated or whatever, because they didn't know that they were burying the money with the man, and then the guy gets set on fire in his coffin? I forget. It's got Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and all those guys are in it. But I saw a parallel between that and the end with the money blowing away,
that.
It's also like they're building a mandala and then whoosh, there it goes.
It's the wind. Windy.
Oh, very much. Exactly. Very much. The wind carries it away.
And it's the dog, right? It's the dog that, you know, basically screws everything up at that point.
Yeah, I noticed that. It was that the dog was the Discord agent there, very much Sirius jumping in and throwing things off. But it's funny that you're connecting this to another movie with the sort of everything getting, the money getting destroyed. I was thinking about a movie called The Castle of Cagliostro. It's a Miyazaki, it's an animated film.
Which is
Lupin, which means wolf. The main character's name is Wolf. His name is Lupin.
Right.
So he's the wolf. And that movie, to me, looks exactly like The British Royal Wedding. It's insane. I put a side-by-side photo. It's insane. So again, we go back to our sapphire ring, the magic ring, because in Castle of Cagliostro, it's this whole idea of the moon princess, Diana, and the Solar King need to join their alchemical rings, and when they do, they basically unleash Atlantis. The Disney movie Atlantis even based footage on this older movie. So you have this Atlantis connection where once the sun and moon are joined, Atlantis is essentially risen again. So the raising of Atlantis...
Oh, which is the pineal and the pituitary.
Yeah.
According to Alice Bailey, she connects it directly to Sirius.
Yeah, you gotta watch. I mean, this movie is
which
so
is the Immaculate Conception. She refers to that, what you're talking about, Alan, as the Immaculate Conception.
Precisely.
Which is the feast. So that's, you know, you have, and then that's Ophiuchus. That's fucking weird.
So
you know what I'm saying? Do you get my jump?
Yeah, I totally do.
That's so.
I think. But just want to throw out there for anyone who's never seen the movie, and I really highly recommend everyone watch it. It was free on YouTube, it might still be. It's called The Castle of Cagliostro. The movie has a scene where they're trying to steal all this money, and then all the money burns. And it's sort of like, oh, well, and the real treasure is the girl. So it's like, you know, what they were actually looking for, the money goes. So I just sort of made, when I saw the killing and all the money gets blown away, it reminded me very much of all the money burning in Castle of Cagliostro.
And then you have his Howl's Moving Castle, which is actually Howl, right? Even though it's H-O-W-L, and when they spelled it in English, even though it's not an English movie. But the person who they have doing the voice of Howl, who is the brain of the moving castle, is Billy Crystal, which is, I don't know, I thought it was interesting because Sapphire Pavement is the intelligence of the thing, you know, it's the
Billy Crystal. Billy Crystal, 23.
Oh yeah, oh. BC. Now,
sorry about that.
Bill points out that the character who plays Nicky, Tim Curry, is the guy from Head. Is his name really Lord High and Low?
In the movie, yeah.
Oh, wow. He's like the sort of like producer who's trying to keep the... He's like the Darth Vader to Head. He's like the main bad
guy. Wait a minute, he's in The Killing?
The guy who plays Nicky, who's also in Paths of Glory, by the way, he's one of the three soldiers who are executed, which again is very Christ-like, that the... You know, the three, the triple execution. Nicky, the guy who plays Nicky in The Killing, is the same guy, is one of the three soldiers executed in Paths of Glory. And Bill reminds us, yes, he is the guy in Head who, that's sort of like the guy with the cape who keeps going like, oh, we can make lunchboxes and whatever. And it's kind of like chasing them around.
Oh, right.
And he gets shot by the cannon.
Yes.
Val cannon.
Oh, there's also the Tsar cannon. That was a thing. So there's the Tsar bomb, and then there's the Tsar cannon. Anyways.
Wow.
It's kind of weird.
So
and then
Tim
cannon is the camera, and then you have your private Joker there again. Huh. He carries the cannon.
Tim Curry, he's 20, right? T would be the 20th.
20th letter and C being 3, yeah. 20 plus 3.
So, 23.
Yeah. And you notice, like, this character has a sort of, like, I don't know if he probably has, like, some real-life medical issue, but he seems to have a sort of Joker-like grin plastered on his mm-hmm. face. He, like, everything he says through gritted teeth. So it's mm-hmm. he's almost like the Joker in that sense of... That sort of constant smile. I don't mean to make, you know, I don't know what his, if he has some sort of medical condition or what it is. I'm not trying to make fun of the guy. I'm just saying he does have this sort of persistent expression on his face.
Well, he reminds me of Benicio del Toro's character in The Usual Suspects.
They'll flip you. They'll flip you for real.
Like, what was that character's name?
It was actually on the tip of my tongue, actually. That's weird. Listen to those keys fly.
Fred Fenster.
He had a nickname, though. Right? They called him something else. It's all right. That's so funny to just see pictures of him the way he squints his fucking eyes, dude. And then he's been coming at my girlfriend watched Traffic the other day, and I walked in the room and I could feel the energy. I'm like, oh god, you know, it's so intense, you know. But then you know, I was thinking about him as the lawyer in Fear and Loathing. It's just I don't know where I'm going. Fear and Loathing is, like, really great. It's been coming up in sync here and there in really odd ways. All right.
So I looked. Castle of Cagliostro is still available on YouTube for free.
Cool.
So I just put the link in Skype. But it's just, I highly recommend this movie. It's awesome. It's just like, it's a really good movie, plus it's sinky as all fuck, so.
Cool. Alright, so we should probably watch that for next week. I'll watch it anyway.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys want to dissect it. I just sort of wanted to throw it out there as an enjoying thing.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But sure, if you...
I don't know. Like, part of me likes having something that we can kind of like center around. You know what I mean? We can all be like, yeah, I saw that, you know?
I kind of want to watch... I was telling Jason the new Adrian Lin Lolita, because I saw it like a long time ago, but I wasn't in the mind state where I was like ready to, you know, do what we've been doing with it. But I don't know. I think we're tripping out on the Shakina Lilith thing a little bit more than most people are. But part of that has to do with, you know, twice a week I go and I study for a number of hours with my rabbi, and that's like a lot of what we're going into inevitably with the text that we're looking at. So I can't help but look for it in fucking everything now.
I wanted to throw a recommendation out there just for everyone. It's a short little thing, and if you got a Netflix account, to go watch it. It's the last episode of season 2 of Cheers.
Okay. 222.
One of the greatest 25 minutes of television I have ever seen. Maybe it's my favorite. And I don't want to give anything away. It'll speak for itself, but it's incredible. And in regards to the Shekinah in exile and what this whole...
Diane Chambers?
Hmm?
Diane Chambers?
Diane Chambers and Sam Malone, who mm-hmm. is in exile from Major League Baseball.
Well, you know, Sam could be short for Samuel, but it could also be short for Samuel, like Samuel, the angel of death.
Mm-hmm.
So that always gets interesting in that regard.
Which gets changed into Sam Hall. If you know the song Sam Hall, Samuel gets changed to Sam Hall. I just wanted to bring that back to...
Yeah. Weird.
It is that song.
Huh. So, Alan, did you ever get a chance to see Melancholia?
No, I did not.
Still a recommendation if you get some time.
Yeah, I don't have a Netflix, so I have to find stuff that's free or bootlegged online. And
you could probably torrent that if you wanted to do that kind of thing. Anyways, whatever. I just think you'd probably get something out of it, because it's got the whole fucking... All the levels of it are just, like, so blatant, and there's... The all the Saturn symbolism is really apparent, because it's basically based around this one wood etching that's from 1514 that pictures the basically like an alchemist philosopher who's just surrounded by Saturn and Jupiter symbolism, and the piece is called Melancholia, and so you can kind of see they show the alchemical marriage, and it's just so rich with symbolism. It's really epic.
Yeah, we were talking last week. There's the idea of the like hot and cold melancholy from Saturn. So this is, I feel like there's definitely something waiting for me in that film. And if I'm not mistaken, it's basically this like sort of blue star coming at Earth. So I know there's something waiting for me in there. I just have to either make the time or. But I'm not trying to disregard your recommendation. I just.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, I wouldn't have watched it if it wasn't on Netflix. That was, like, kind of a random thing. And also, never mind. So, are we approaching the end, my friend?
I think we're kind of winding down here. I got to get running soon, so... So if you guys decide something that you, like if you have a definitive something you want to do for next week, shoot it out on Facebook and we can make that happen.
I mean, whatever. We don't have to, but I thought it was kind of a cool idea. They got me to like actually look for stuff in the movie. I always find something if I'm looking.
How about everyone goes out and buys a San Pedro cactus?
Hey, hey.
Cool.
Sounds like a plan.
No, really.
That I can find time for.
You've heard the return of Jack and Jill, and I was just looking at in book 4, Crowley's book 4, where he's talking about Jack and Jill as basically, you know, Jack being Malkuth climbing the...
Yeah, that shit's brilliant.
Climbing the tree to get to the water, which would be Bina, which would be the waters of Bina. So he's trying to get an understanding, and he falls down and breaks his crown, which is Keter. Keter is crown. And Jill came tumbling after. It's like the conscious is going, climbing, ascending the tree, and the subconscious is following. And if the conscious falls, the subconscious follows suit, literally. So I don't know. I haven't read your Return of Jack and Jill part one.
That's awesome. Two. I've done a number of Jack and Jill posts. It basically stems out of the Gabriel Gifford shooting. She's, of course, GG-77. She's married to a NASA astronaut. So for me, her getting shot in the head, this sort of broken crown, she was a congresswoman, so she goes up the hill, right? Literally, like we say, Capitol Hill. And her husband being a NASA astronaut, you have Jack Parsons. So there seemed to be this sort of narrative playing out of she's shot by Jared Lee Loner, or JLL. So Jack Parsons and Jared Lee Loner is Jack and Jill, JLL. With the going up the hill, breaking the crown, you have this sort of not only just the headshot, but the the King Kill as the broken crown is very much evidence of a, you know, the sort of Sixth Semper Tyrannus. There's a whole narrative that I've seen sort of playing out that I've touched on a number of times, but it's something that got so big. It's essentially the book I'm trying to write is not just about Jack and the modern Jack and Jill with Gabriel Giffords, but with how this narrative seems to continue to play out. But that's very much where it was inspired by this. Noticing the royal wedding coinciding with Gabriel Gifford's story, that there was, you know, her husband was going back into space at the time of the royal wedding. Barack Obama was supposed to be with Gabriel Giffords on the day that, you know, it's like it just sort of like plays out over and over, this connection. It's big. It's hard to like really sum up quickly, but I think, you know, I think you get the idea. It's very much this narrative is playing out as a Jack and Jill story, but it's also a play. It's a play on the words.
Yeah. Well, we go into the Muppets a lot. What the fucking Muppets, dude, that's so weird. I mean, the whole like Christian Science thing, I was trying to find, like, it's, there's so little information, like, there, I don't know. I know Jim Henson didn't remain a Christian Scientist as he was before, when he was raised, but from what I gather looking at it, it seems as though he was from the Packhurst Quimby Christian Science, which is much different from the Mary Baker Eddy Christian Science. Crowley used to call Mary Baker Eddy an intellectual prostitute. Like, and I've read from other people talk from the time saying that when they met her, they couldn't understand how she wrote Science and Health, you know, like, and how Christian Science completely did a shift, and not everybody followed along with the shift, and not everybody like bought into the new Christian Science. And so now people that know about Christian Science have all these associations with it, which are all Mary Baker Eddy. But Packhurst Quimby is really cool. Like, I read some of his stuff when I was like 22 or 21 or something. I really liked it. He was actually a doctor who basically was just acknowledging natural healing, and very practical, extremely practical.
I was given a copy of Science and Health by this woman that I want to tell you a quick story about, but just break down the name Mary Baker Eddy, and Eddy is a whirlwind or a whirlpool. Baker is, again, our cook, our alchemical cook. So you have, like, Isis, the cook of the Deadpool, the swirling whirlpool, or your Norway spiral. Just want to throw that out there. But I met a woman who was a Christian Scientist who gave me a copy of Science and Health that I still have, And this woman, this was during a period where I was getting, shortly after I was getting my weird little serious contact, whatever that was, and I met this woman, and we had a sort of Danny Torrance, Halloran experience, where this woman spoke to me. This probably sounds fucking crazy, but there's this old black woman who actually had a leg wound. It's actually really funny. She was a patient of mine. I was doing healthcare at the time, and I would go to her house, and we would just sit there and talk. And she had a really bad leg problem that her, I don't remember exactly what it was, but like a gangrene or something. Like her leg was sort of like falling apart, so she couldn't really move much. But we would just sit and have conversations, and one of the few people I could have really intense conversations with. And I would go, and she, I remember like one night she picks up the phone, and she was from Uganda, I think, and she starts speaking her native language to someone on the phone for a few minutes and says, "Hey, I'm with somebody, I'll call you back," and hangs up. And then like that night I went home, and as I was falling asleep, I started hearing her voice in my mind speaking her native language, but I could understand it. It was a total, what do you call it, like Pentecost experience, you know, this sort of like, I could understand this other language. And I actually, around that time, I had a number of experiences like that, where even though I was hearing other languages, I could understand them. I wish I could say that continued. But it was a really strange experience in this period of time. Whatever shift my mind went into in that period was really fucking powerful. So this woman, we would have really intense conversations, and I told you guys about my getting the lottery numbers, where like I said in the dream, like, "Hey, if you can show me something, show me." I didn't ask for lottery numbers. I said, "If you could prove it to me." And then I'm in the store, and I get the lottery numbers. Well, I saw her a few days later, and she just looks at me. I didn't tell her anything, and she looks at me, and she goes, "You know, I was sitting here the other day watching the TV, and And suddenly I saw what the lottery numbers were going to be." And I say, "Oh, really?" She goes, "Yeah." She goes, "And then I watched as the numbers came up on the TV, and they were right." And I said, "Oh, that's all." And, you know, but she was talking about like, you know, $100 million lottery. And here's this like poor woman living in the projects of Harlem. I mean, you know, like literally just sitting there going like, I saw the lottery numbers. And I'm like, "So why didn't you play?" And she was just like, "No, that didn't seem like the right thing to do." And it was really interesting. But like, I didn't tell her I had just, you know, won the lottery by getting numbers from somewhere. And then I go into her apartment, and she's like, "So I'm sitting here and I get lottery numbers, but I didn't play." So I was like, but she was a Christian Scientist, and she gave me Science and Health. But I didn't. That didn't really speak to me more than just some sort of personal connection that really spoke to me.
Cool.
I mean, literally spoke to me in a really intense way.
Right. I was kind of I was looking at A Course in Miracles. I've read the text a number of times. I find it reconciling for anybody who is raised with intense Christian programming, in terms of if that's in your mind, it's good to set things in a different light, you know. But that when I was in the desert in Arizona, staying with these grandmothers who were in their 80s, who all built mud huts and were relatively self-sustaining out, and they collected monsoon water, and it's really incredible. But anyways, one of them worked with the woman at Berkeley who channeled A Course in Miracles, and she told me, you know, her story about how she was raised atheist and all this business, and had no previous knowledge of any of this Christian business, and this stuff all came out of her. It's considered a Christian Scientist book by many, it's kind of, it's strange that the man who she worked with, who basically wrote down, or, you know, took what she was writing and put it, you know, helped her along with the process of getting it all together as a book, that he was working for a sub project of MK Ultra on psychology.
Oh,
I mean, there
shit.
Was a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But that's just kind of, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot going on there, but at the same time, he had ties with all these people in MK Ultra. And so I also find it interesting that the head guy who everybody basically who came forward with the presidential committee when they were looking into MK Ultra says the same name of this one doctor who was Dr. Green. And I always thought funny, like, it's not easy being green, you know, like this MK Ultra doctor. But anyways, there's also the side of that. And then the fact that Yoda's speech is modeled after A Course in Miracles. So the way that A Course in Miracles is spoken, if you look at the writing, it's basically Yoda. And Yoda is voiced and puppeteered Frank Oz.
Right.
And so there's your Oz character, right? But then Frank Oz was the co-producer of The Dark Crystal with Jim Henson. And so there's just, there's some weird connections there. You go from MK Ultra, yes, and specifically Christian Science, A Course in Miracles, with Jim Henson being raised a Christian Scientist, with this whole Frank Oz business. And then there's also the weird level of that the Muppets version of Star Wars has Gonzo as Darth Vader. Meanwhile, Gonzo is voiced by Frank Oz, who is Yoda. So basically, in a sense, you're looking at Yoda as Darth Vader, which is just a weird concept. But anyway.
Which it's actually really appropriate, though, yeah. Just to say, I watched a documentary on the making the Dark Crystal where Frank Oz and Jim Henson talk about their sort of working process where I guess Frank Oz was given more creative control on Dark Crystal than on previous projects. And Frank Oz seems like a bit of an asshole. like he looked like a pretty like intense like Hollywood nightmare guy to work with, and yet his genius is undeniable. So,
yeah. Whereas Mark LeClaire would emphasize that Kubrick was an asshole, you know?
Right. Yeah, but
that's, you know, yeah. That's what it takes sometimes, you know?
God, if you want to get shit done, you need an asshole.
Right.
Ba-dum-bum. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. I got to run. Have a great day, okay?
Okay.
Adios, amigos.
All right, talk to you guys next week.
I shook the hand of the president and the Pope in Rome. I've been to parties where I've had to be flown. They said everything was sacred, nothing was profane. And money was something that you throw off the back of trains. Oh, always keep a dime in your mind. You got to always keep a dime in your mind. Wherever you may wander, wherever you may roam, you got to always keep a dime in your mind. Of the gravy with little fried pearls floating like a necklace on a beautiful girl. Jonah says thanks to the food and the land, and oh, so ever grateful for God's almighty hands. Oh, always keep a dime in your mind. Keep a dime in your mind. Wherever you may wander, wherever you may roam, you got to always keep a dime in your mind. She's got the milk of human kindness and the fat of the lamb. Scared like a baby, but she drives like a man. She lives outside of Natchez and she operates a crane. She's like a wrecking ball that no longer connected to the chain. Oh, Sarah Ellis. Samuel says she almost never prayed since she lost her right arm, blown off in a pink of the rain.